Hi, this is Josh Kuhn, here with dublab.com, and thrilled to be sitting across the radio board from one of the great legends of broadcasting and one of the great legends of LA music culture, the great Art LeBeau.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Josh.
There it is. See, I can't even do the radio voice. Can you teach me how to do that?
No.
No, see, can't. Where are we? I mean, our listeners obviously can't see this incredible place that we're in right now.
Well, we're almost on the corner of Sunset Boulevard and La Brea Avenue, actually in the heart of Hollywood. This is one of the main corners. And I've been in this little funky studio here since 1961. This used to be my office. Now it's the control room for the radio.
And you can identify it by the big original sound billboard that looks pretty vintage.
It is.
The sign
it's
out on the street.
It's the 70s.
Yeah. And so you originally, this was just the office? This was not a recording studio when you first...
No, the recording studio is adjacent.
Okay.
And when we enlarged the radio studio, we moved the wall, made my office a little smaller. This office, it was put together in the 60s. We had an S-looking couch here and a full bar, and it was quite a spot.
Now what is the decision that has to happen that the full bar goes away?
We have to go across the street.
Okay.
In those days, right, there was a bar across the street.
Did it make the shows different when you had a full bar in the office?
No.
Okay.
No, I never did the show from here in those days.
Okay.
The show has been done from this studio since 1995. Prior to that, I did shows at some of the radio stations, and at one time from one of my bedrooms at home.
Well, that made it easy.
A little bit. I didn't do the whole show from there. It was
just roll out of
somewhat
bed.
Somewhat convoluted since I'm an engineer. I started the show from my house and drove to the studio.
Nice.
Sometimes I just went to the studio.
One of the things I think that's really special about this studio, unlike other radio studios you might go to on FM radio, is you actually don't see a lot of posters and photographs that are promotional from record labels and big superstars and corporate sponsorships all over. What you mostly see are photographs from fans and letters. And incredibly, you know, walls covered with personalized messages to you. It's a very intimate space. Could you talk a little bit about how your show is as much about the musical experience as it is about this experience of a kind of intimacy with your fans?
Well, I invite the fans to send the pictures in, you know, of themselves or with their pet, their cat or dog or their husband or their boyfriend or whatever. And they send them in, and then we usually send them a picture back. And sometimes we get drawings. Different people are pretty creative about it. They'll send me posters from a show that they might be doing, or album cover, or those kind of things. It's just a sort of a potpourri of you know, listeners' material and things that they identify with. And then as I look around as I'm doing the show, it also helps me because I feel like I'm looking around and I get the idea of who's out there. That's one thing about radio. You know, you're in a little studio somewhere with a microphone, and that's all you have, and it's hard to connect it to realize you're talking to so many people. And when hopefully each person, at least in my view, the way I approach it is, it's a one-on-one. Mm-hmm. So each person hopefully feels that you're talking to them. I mean, I got a call last night from a guy named Sam in Oxnard, and he said, "I'm listening at work." So came time, a record ended, and I said, "Hey, Sam, the radio's talking to you." And I can visualize him, you know, doing whatever work he does, which I don't know. And just the, you don't hear that, you know, and on the radio. And the, and I could just see him moving his head. Like, what?
I mean, don't you think for so many of your fans, and you hear this a lot when people talk about you, and particularly in the contemporary moment, your value as a broadcaster, as a DJ, as an on-air person, is that you make people feel noticed, that you give individuals a sense that somebody's listening to them, that their names mean something to you and their stories are actually connecting with you. I mean, it's very rare these days when we can feel that kind of personal experience with this voice that maybe we've heard for 10 years, 20 years on the radio, that maybe a voice that meant something to our parents and to our brothers and sisters, that then says our name.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's hard for me to identify with the other side, but I just try to make it easy for them. And that's the whole key, you know, is to get them to talk. I mean, as you say, I've been on here a long time. People have heard me a lot. So like any interview, what you're doing right now is getting the other guy to talk. And right. It's the same when I talk to a listener. Mm-hmm. I want to see what they have to say. And it's hard to draw a listener out because they're not professionals. And I try to tell them that they're not on the air. We always record our listeners first for obvious reasons. But they usually get back on the air within minutes, like 10 minutes. And I tell them that, and it puts them at ease. Because many people, when they call in, think they're going right on the air. They even have the radio turned up, and I have to tell them to turn it off so I can record it.
I mean, I think if someone, you know, who hasn't listened to your show for the first time is listening to it, my guess is that what they're going to notice that separates it from any other show currently on the air, but certainly maybe in any other show ever, is not just what kind of music you're playing, and we'll come back to that in a second, but what happens in between the songs, the dedications, that comfort level where people are working so hard to get on the air to dedicate their songs to someone. And it's not just random dedications. These are very personal dedications to loved ones, to family members, to people who are in prison, to people who have passed. And so there, if you could talk a little bit about maybe the history of the shout out and the dedication on your show. When did you start having that be part of
your
shows?
I did dedications on my first radio program, which was in 1943 at KSAN in San Francisco. That was my first commercial station. I was in the Navy. I was assigned to Treasure Island outside of San Francisco. And of course, I still had the radio bug since I was 8, and I was now just turned 18. And I got a gig doing a little bit of a board as a board op. And I think I may have told this story before. I've told it a few times, but I'll tell you how I got my first job, because people ask me that a lot. You know, how'd you get started? And that's the first question at parties or interviews. And it is kind of unique, because just before I went in the Navy, I was going to Stanford studying radio engineering. So when I went to KSAN, I had this little squeaky voice, and I was even smaller than I am now. I was about 5'3", and I weighed 105 pounds. I walked into KSAN pretty brazenly and asked the secretary if I could see the general manager. In those days, it wasn't quite as hard to get in as it is now. She didn't know what I wanted. She just said, yeah, down the hall, second door, and his name is Mr. Akers. So I walked down there, and my little voice said, Mr. Akers, I'm here to kind of look for a job. And he looked up. He was a big man, and he looked up over his glasses and says, who are you? What do you want? And how'd you get in here? So he fried me down to about 2 inches tall, and I said, I thought I might be able to do some radio work, be on the air here, you know. No, he says, you don't have the voice for it. You're too young. He says, we don't have anything for you. He says, sorry, he said. And I says, oh, well, okay. And I started to walk out the door, and he says, besides, he says, you have to have an FCC license, a third-class radio telephone. We use combination people here. So I turned around and walked over, and I said, you mean one of these? And I pulled out a first-class radio telephone, a telegraph license, and a radio ham license. And with those licenses, I could operate any kind of radio station anywhere in the world. But he looked at that first-class telephone. He said, you're hired. And I said, but I thought you – he says, no, you're hired, son. He comes over around, then he puts his arm around me, and he says, you see that license there? He says, all my engineers have been drafted. I should have said earlier, this is during World War II. He said, all my engineers have been drafted, and I'm operating illegally. And if I hire you, I'm legal. And that's how I got my first job.
Nice.
So you never know, you know, what how you get started.
Right.
And then I had a little bit of airtime. You know, I used to come in, do the station IDs, and then near at the end of the schedule, which was midnight, 11 to 12, no one wanted to buy. So we would play records. There were no such thing as DJs yet. It was just you were an announcer and you played records. So I had that hour.
And like, what kind of songs were you playing? What kind of music?
I was playing, at that time, big bands, still playing Glenn Miller and Artie Shaw and Duke Ellington and even Billie Holiday and all kinds of things like that. You know.
And in between those songs, you started to do...
I'd talk, yeah, a little bit.
And scared, would you do dedications? And you started to do dedications?
Well, yes, I thought I'd try it. And so I invited people to write in. And they did. I'd get a few letters, like half a dozen, you know. And now around here, sometimes we get 100 a day. But I've got these letters, and it was exciting that I'd read them on the air. This is for so-and-so and so-and-so.
How would you say that the content of the dedications have changed since
then? Not a lot. You'd be surprised. It was still mostly in those days, and there were young girls, and there still are, calling in, and a lot of other people, too. But the teenagers of today, you know, and we're in 2012 here, are different in the sense that they have a lot of other things to do besides listen to the radio. In 1943, there were only two things. There was movies and radio. There was nothing else. There was no cell phones and there was no games, video games, or nothing else. That's it. So radio became the thing. And, of course, this was a small station and it did not play a lot of music. It was not a music station. And the only music stations I recall in those days that were total music stations were classical. There were a couple of classical stations in the big cities. Otherwise, the only time you'd hear music on the radio is when they didn't have the time sold, or it was a time, like I said, at 11 o'clock where there was a time to fill. Mm-hmm. So the announcer on duty would play some records. There were only three record companies, RCA, Columbia, and what they called Decca Records then, which was now Universal. As usual, Josh, I'm giving you a long answer to a short question.
But all good, important stories. So when did you first come down to L.A.? Well, you first made it to actually out to the desert, right, to Palm Springs? It was first, before Los Angeles?
No, I went from KSAN. I had to finish the war. So I was a radio operator on Pan Am Clippers, which the Navy had taken over. That's what I did. I went to Hawaii 147 times. I'd counted them all. And I had 250,000 logged hours in 2.5 years working for Pan Am. So L.A.'s my home. And after the war, I came home to L.A. And couldn't get a job. And all the big time, it was still only radio. It was still no television. It was 1946. So it was still just movies and radio. So I went around to the radio stations and couldn't get in the door because all the big-time announcers and people that were in the war were coming back. They knew everybody, and couldn't get started. I finally got a job doing an all-night show here in L.A.
On which station was that?
KRKD.
KRKD.
The towers are still there downtown Los Angeles at, I think it's 5th and Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Spring Arcade building. So KRKD, RKD is, you know, phonetically supposed to spell arcade. Okay. And those call letters are still up there, and it's a historical monument.
And what kind of songs were you playing then?
Well, at that time, then, music had changed a little. Some more of the pop artists of the day were there. Even, I think, Sinatra had already started. We played Joe Stafford. We played Patti Page. We played people like that. It was in the late 40s. We started to play some things. There were some R&B records around then. Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five and a few people like that.
Mm-hmm. And that
Slim
must have been...
Gaylord was there. I remember him. I met him later. And other people, a mixture of music. There was no real popular music. You could call pop music, you know. And we were still playing the big bands all over the place. I mean, we were still playing Glenn Miller, and even though he died during the war, we still had Tommy Dorsey and some new bands, Jerry Gray, a few others. So there was a lot of just pop music, popular music, and still the bands had the horns and the vocalists that sat there and got up and sang, and we were playing those people.
I mean, that late 40s, early 50s period in L.A. music was, as you well know, I mean, one of the richest, most incredible times for black music in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Central Avenue scene was thriving. To what extent did that kind of overlap with your world on the radio?
Well, I was in L.A. in 1946, and then I went to a station in Pomona where I could be more on the air. I wanted to be on the air more instead of being on overnight. And then I went to Palm Springs in 1947 and got a job at KCMJ, which is still there. And it was the only station in Palm Springs. So people could, if they couldn't hear anything else, because the LA stations still can't get into Palm Springs, only the Palm Springs stations. And now there's probably 15 stations there, maybe more. I'm on one of them, KDES.
Is there a radio station in the United States you're not on?
Well, I'm on iHeartRadio, so that goes all over the country now. It's Clear Channels. It's gaining a lot of steam now.
We could try to play a game at home where we invite listeners to try to not listen to Art LeBeau on the radio.
Oh,
try to not find it, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of my salespeople when I was doing this syndicated show, and I was on, still I believe I'm on these same stations. Well, I was on an L.A. station, not the same one I'm on now, 92.3, but I was on, I think it was on KRLA in L.A. then, and then I was on in Palm Springs on KDES, and I was on 99.1 KGGI, and one of the salesmen had his girlfriend. They were going to Palm Springs, and they had my show on, and she said, can I turn set the dial somewhere else, or can I get to a different station, maybe hear something else? And he says, yeah, go ahead. So she turns, and Art LeBeau comes out of the next button, and then she twists the dial, and Art LeBeau comes out again. She says, this is the funniest radio. She said, only gets Art LeBeau. But they happened to be just in that little triangle, my Radio Bermuda Triangle, which is where the Palm Springs station came in with what we call a city-grade signal. And then L.A. still comes in strong until you go around the mountain. And 99.1 is in Riverside. So they were all strong, you know. So as she went across the dial, her seeker just hit those, I guess. I'm not sure whether she was turning or pushing buttons.
I think it'd be a good experiment. It'd be a really interesting kind of sound art project to try to see how long you can drive across the Southwest without hearing Art LeBeau.
Sometimes at the present day, you can hear four stations that I know of because San Diego comes in. So if you get down around Orange County, you're going to be able to hear at least four.
Do you ever feel bad for your competitors who just can't get on the air and you just dominate and dominate?
I never feel bad for competitors. I don't mean to be braggadocious, but I do have to tell you this story because I was real proud of it at the time.
I don't mean to brag, but
I'm going to brag. Well, this is something to brag about. The ratings in Los Angeles in the 90s when I started, call it my radio comeback, because I hadn't really done a full-fledged radio show in L.A. since 1980.
OK. Okay.
But I was doing a little taped show with Doo-Wop, the Doo-Wop Shop for KRLA because they asked me to. So I was continuously on, but not in the front lines. And KGGI was where I started the present show 21 years ago. And the show just broke loose. It went crazy. And one of the ratings came out, was Arbitron, and I had a 49 share. And my show was number one, and all the other stations together in that area were number two. And you, in Riverside, you can hear about 20, 25 stations. And that was something. I kept that. I have it somewhere.
Now, when
I was barely number one, but I was.
Oh, that's a good thing to just,
everybody
that's
else
a good motto.
All together, and even the LA stations get into Riverside. I was quite excited about that.
Art, you will always be number one to me.
Thank you. It's a harder struggle.
I know. I know that means a lot to you.
But with the people meter, it's a little harder because when they had the diaries out there, they had 7,000 diaries in L.A. People meter has 2,000 now. Hmm. And everything is sampled, so it's possible to get big ratings on a certain time of day and certain demo.
But certainly the internet has changed. I mean, it's changed everything in radio, but it's also change the way you do radio. I mean, you're online, you're very active on social media. I mean, the internet's become part of your show. People can send dedications through Facebook, on Twitter, all kinds of other avenues, right?
Yeah, and especially now since I'm on the Clear Channel station in Los Angeles is my flagship station, and it is on iHeartRadio. So I have a link from artlebeau.com to iHeartRadio. And I'm getting people from everywhere. It's just amazing. You know, I get people from Texas. I had a girl from Texas, Houston. And I said, she says, I listen to you all the time. And I said, well, you're in Houston, Texas. There must be 30 stations there. Why do you listen to me? I said, you know, why this show? She says, because there's nothing like this at all in Houston. And I said, like what? Why? What makes it different? I wanted her viewpoint. And she said, well, there's nobody that lets you talk on the air, talks to you, and really does your dedications and plays what you want most of the time. Mm-hmm. And you put people on from everywhere. There's nobody does that. I thought, well, somebody must do it somewhere, but they don't do that. Mm-hmm. They don't put the people on. Right. I put all kinds of people on. I put a grandmother on. I'll put a 10-year-old. I had a 1-year-old once just saying, ga-ga-ga-ga-goo. I think that was a record.
Yeah.
I had a good slogan I was going to use, but I don't use it. From Art LeBeau, you listen to Art LeBeau from womb to tomb.
There's something to that, Art. I would copyright that real quick. Real quick.
I never said it on the air except now. That's
maybe
true.
We'll run it with this story.
I still from old school. They used to get on us when we said hell or damn. I mean, you could be fired. Admonished from radio forever.
So when you were starting, let's go back to the L.A. kind of in the early 50s moment, or the 1950s in Los Angeles, and the big band and pop songs
and
that...
You could hear a little of everything on the radio.
Right.
You're talking about mid-50s now?
I wanted to talk specifically about the transition from big band and pop, as you were talking about it, to what became known as rock and roll. Which, of course, was originally R&B in some ways. And there's a whole longer conversation about the politics of race and how R&B became rock and all that you were very much a part of.
Yeah. Little Richard says it the best. He says, rhythm and blues had a baby and they named it rock and roll.
And you were active in playing some of the first rock records in Los Angeles on the West Coast.
Because I was playing rhythm and blues in the early 50s, in 51, 52. You know, everybody says, when did rock and roll start? I believe it started in late 1955 when Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis and all those people mm-hmm. came on the scene. But the rhythm and blues, and who later became some of these artists that became what you call rock and roll artists, like Big Joe Turner and Ruth Brown and all the R&B artists became rock and roll artists, mostly on Atlantic Records. And they made the transition just very easily. But the transition between pop music, the big bands and the vocalists, the Sinatras and some of the other vocalists of the day, was slow. The Billboard charts, if you look at them in 1954 and 55 and 56, there's a big mishmash of top artists there. And so little by little, the pop artists, the big bands, fell off the charts, and then rock and roll became predominant with Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Gene Pitney and others.
But you kept playing the black R&B artists as well, of course.
Yes, I did. And broke a lot of those records on my drive-in show.
Like, for example?
Song like Shake, Rattle, and Roll, Big Joe Turner, Corrine Corina, things like that, were made for rock and roll. You know, even though Shake, Rattle, and Roll was a traditional old R&B song, it was done differently. You know, they did it in a bigger and better studio and more bands and legendary artists. People like Fats Domino emerged, a whole bunch of artists out of New Orleans.
So when you were playing these songs in the 1950s in Los Angeles and you were playing R&B by predominantly African American artists, and you were playing music that was now being called rock and roll in many cases by white artists, were you thinking at that time, when was race like part of the way you thought about music? And did you think about it in terms of your fans? Did you know who was listening to you? Did it matter to you?
Well, I knew because I was doing a show at a drive-in restaurant late at night, Scrivener's in L.A., and it was a late-night show from midnight to 4 in the morning. And I would walk around, talk to people in their cars. So there'd be a lot of kids, especially on weekends. And they would tell me what I should play and say, well, have you heard this or have you heard that? And I'd say, no. Well, I've got it. I'll bring it to you. And they'd bring it, and I had a turntable there where I could play it. And they'd get it'd be a big reaction. Then I'd start playing it more, just playing it on the air.
Right.
But the R&B artists...
At Scribner's, were those kids, was it mostly white kids? Was it white and black?
And later, when I did another show for Scribner's, when it got to be 1956, that all-night show was in the early 50s, 51, 52, 53. I was there for almost 5 years. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I had been to Palm Springs and Reno, and then I came back to L.A. and decided I'd try this all-night show in the afternoon. So I went back to Scribner's, and he liked the idea, so we came on the air at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in L.A. in the summer, late summer of 55. And, of course, the show just skyrocketed then because rock and roll was just at the crest of the wave, and like a surfer that catches the wave, there I was sitting right on top of it. And I had a lot of knowledge that I'd gained over the years that I'd been doing the all-night show, and I started playing that music that I knew the kids liked. And the only other one that was playing such kind of music was Hunter Hancock. And Hunter Hancock only played black artists. He would not play any white artists. And the white artists actually emulated the black artists in rock and roll in the beginning. That's where they got their ideas and style, even though they added their own. Even Elvis, I mean, it's well known, anybody knows the history of Elvis, that he used to go to the black side of town and jam with some of the guys there that used to just sit in their front porch and play the guitar, and another guy would bang on a bucket and that kind of thing, and Elvis would go there. And so he was highly influenced by the early rhythm and blues. Mm-hmm. It's all over the place.
I mean, one of the things, you know, in looking back on that period, in particularly LA music history, is one way I think you could look at Los Angeles in those days is that in the 1950s was still very much a kind of racially segregated city in terms of populations and where they lived in the city. And yet the music scene, I found that the deeper you dig into the history of music in LA, particularly in that period, you see that all of that segregation actually got crossed and mixed through music. There's that great photo, and granted this is not LA proper, but there's that great El Monte Legion Stadium photograph of you broadcasting with this sea of teenagers behind you. And it's a sea of teenagers who are black and brown and white, and it's a complete mixed scene that from mid-50s, right?
Yeah, mid-50s. And on into 56, 57, 58, 59.
So was that your sense? Was that music was crossing lines in Los Angeles?
I think it was bringing people together because the young people didn't have any prejudices. I didn't notice any, especially when it came to music. Mm-hmm. They all liked the same thing. And you're right about them being segregated because most of the people, even today, are black people in the south part of Los Angeles. The Latinos mostly in the eastern part of Los Angeles and out into the valley. And all the white kids came from Westwood or, you know, West L.A. or even Hollywood. I mean, if you go to Hollywood High today, you see a big mixture of people. Mm-hmm. But in 1955, they're all blonde and blue-eyed almost.
And so the music that you played started to become kind of like the foundation, at least, for...
You know, at the drive-in, and I've shown you some pictures of those where I'm there with Ricky Nelson. In that case there, it depended on who I had as a guest that day. When I had Ricky Nelson, I had mostly white teenage girls. I'd have the Crickets or somebody like Jackie Wilson or even Chuck Berry or Bo Diddley. Then I'd have a big mixture of people. That's the way that went. But you got to remember, one of the advantages I had was the fact that I was there. I was outside right with everybody, right with the kids every day. So it was like a built-in research. Nowadays, they put them in an auditorium, and they're all hand-picked, and they say, well, you like this song, you like that song, you like that song. But some of that instinct, I guess you'd call it, for what's right to play that will cross over. You know, it's like the old saying, you know, what's the best kind of music? What's your formula? And I said, the big formula is three things, you know, crossover, crossover, crossover. Play the music that crosses all the lines if you can. It's harder now.
But also in that photo that I was mentioning, it's almost if you're not careful, you'll miss you in the picture. You blend in with the audience. And I think that this is something that what you just said goes back throughout your whole career, is that you've never approached radio, you've never approached being a DJ, playing songs for people as something that you're up on a pedestal or up on high or somehow separate from your audience, but that you need to be with your audience and they need to be part of you in order for you to serve them in the way that you know how to do.
Well, that happened, mostly because of that drive-in experience, you know, where I was there for many years. I mean, the all-night show for 4 years and the afternoon show for three, at least, maybe more. I can't remember exactly, but... So I had about 7 to 8 years being with an audience. So when I go in the studio, I still have that inner feeling that I'm there and they're there. And especially only though we're doing it on the phone, it's still there. It's not quite. And whenever I do go out in the audience at concerts, like I had a 5-minute stage wait just last month. And we had some track artists where they bring their tracks and then the band has to set up. And so then I'm going to try something. I had a disc jockey there from Palm Springs. I said, you take the mic out in the audience and find some people and I'll talk to them from the stage and let them talk back. And it was one of the first times we'd done that. And it really went over big. I mean, people were applauding and laughing and we were just finding who's that next to you, you know? And then the guy got in the audience. It was a big crowd, I think 5,000 or so, and he was down in front. And I says, Victor, go on towards the back there and get some other people. So he disappeared into the crowd, and I said, where are you? And he says, I'm here. And I'm looking at 5,000 people, and I said, well, I don't know where that is, and everybody laughs, you know. So we were doing it there at the concert, which is, you know, last month, right. June 2012. Right.
But I have to say, I saw some photos from what, maybe this was the same concert or a different one of a Latin freestyle show, where I think part of the other reason why you connect with your fans and are so easily noticed by your fans are the outfits you wear, Art LeBeau. There were some incredible outfit changes going on.
Yeah.
I saw a little gold lame number.
Freestyle Explosion concert, were you?
No, that's. I think I saw those. I saw a little gold number. That was quite something.
Now I have a whole bunch of different ones. We had a concert where we had Lisa, and we had
Debbie Deb,
and Stevie B. Mm-hmm. This is one of the first ones that I've done, which brought the music into the 80s, and we didn't know how that would work. But I do play those artists, but not heavily. And we just had a monstrous crowd, and they loved it, you know, because
people think of you as a voice, but they don't think of you as a style icon. And I think it's time.
I guess not.
I think we need to see your clothes. We need to see your. We need to get inside the Art LeBeau wardrobe.
When I get down with people, I mean, they really just feel like they know me, you know. And if I ever get down in the crowd, and often I do.
So let me ask you about the genre term that you are most affiliated with, of course, which is oldies but goodies, which I'm actually sitting on the board that I'm sitting at here. I'm looking at a series of cues under the heading oldies but goodies, and among the things I see are some, looks like an ad for Viagra, some Proactive, Inner Thrive, and Ageless Male. So I'm wondering, is there a connection, Art LeBeau, between oldies but goodies and ageless masculinities and
that.
Inner thriving?
I would say there is. I mean, today there's a lot of advertising that you hear on the radio that you probably wouldn't hear ordinarily, but businesses isn't what it used to be in advertising.
And I think you must be taking Ageless Male because you look pretty good, my friend.
That's called testosterone.
Yeah, I'm telling you. I think this is all the way for you to get all these pills and just live to be 120.
Actually, I don't use those pills. I use the real ones.
We're going to get to Art LeBeau's health regimen in a second. But what for you, what makes an oldie but goodie? How would you define it?
It defines itself. It's old, but it's got to be good. And that was how that all started, because it started at the drive-in again in about the middle of 1956. I used to pass out a list, and then I'd let them pick songs from the list, and I'd call them in, and the station would cue them up and play them. And then while that song was playing, I'd go to the next car and have a one-way conversation to the board op at the station, and he had all the songs, and we had about 20 or 30 of the top hits. And people start asking for songs that were older, like 3 or 4 years old. The teenagers would ask for, a high school senior would ask for a song like Earth Angel that was popular when they were junior high school. And so play me one of those old songs, you know. And I said, like what? And they'd say, Pledging My Love or Earth Angel. I'd say, well, that's not very old. Said, yeah, it is. I was in junior high then. You know, I just barely was in junior high. Now I've got a job. I'm out of graduate or I'm in college. So, you know, so it had to be old, but it had to be good. If it was old, it's okay. If it's just plain old, it was no good. It had to be good. So it's an oldie, but it's good.
But like if you listen to your show over and over again, there's going to be a kind of, at least a handful of standards that you'll probably hear over a few weeks, over a month, right? That repeat, that are popular, that are oldies but goodies in that sense.
Some of them, 20 years, you hear
absolutely
the same one. Like mentioned one earlier, Rosie, you know, Angel Baby.
Always and Forever.
They still ask for
doesn't
that.
Go away.
Yeah, they still ask for them. And I think, might make the show kind of dull because it's the same music every night, you know. So I try to slip in some other stuff here and there. But about 80 to 90% of the music still played comes directly from those that call in.
But it's not just that, it's not only that your audience who is aging with you is choosing oldies but goodies, songs that meant something to them when they were younger, but it's also younger people who are requesting these older songs.
Yeah,
I think that's really important and really interesting about your show, are 20-year-olds who want to hear a song that was popular in 1965 or in 1970. Or
Arbitron now in their rating service starts at 6 to 11, and then 12 to 17, and then and they just started this category of 6 to 11. So I started catering to the younger kids. You don't hear young people on the air. So I thought, well, I'll try it, you know. I was invited. I don't care what age you are. Just call in. So I found that the parents would be right there coaching a five-year-old because they wanted to hear their kid on the radio. I figured, well, maybe the parent might be carrying a people meter, you know, and they would be categorized somewhere else.
So you have a five-year-old requesting Always and Forever, and you know that there's a parent behind them.
Yeah, actually, it actually happened just a few nights ago. I had a girl call in, and he said, my grandma wants to hear Justin Bieber. And
I said, nice.
I said, are you sure that it's your grandma that wants to hear Justin Bieber? And she goes, well, I said, how old are you? She says, I'm 9. And I says, okay, I'm going to play Justin Bieber for your grandma, right? I won't tell. Here it is.
So you don't only, of course, play oldies but goodies, but you've for many, many, many years now been marketing that term and putting out records under the heading of Oldies But Goodies through your own record label, Original Sound. Where did that, these were, if I'm not mistaken, this was the first time that it was a kind of collection of hits,
old hits on
one record, yeah. Right? You basically invented that format.
Well, yeah, I'm the first one that came up with the concept.
And what year was this? This was?
It would be right about 1959.
Yeah, this began with the Oldies But Goodies compilations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Volume 1 came out, I believe, in October of 59.
And that series is still ongoing in ways, yes.
Yeah, it's still ongoing, although the record sales are not what they used to be. And I'm not in the record business anymore, but I still own Oldies But Goodies. Time Life used it recently and paid us a nice royalty per package.
And how long was Original Sound as a label active?
From 1959 until actively probably 2006 or 2007.
It's a long run.
Yeah, we still have people that want to try to buy some things. Most of the licenses we have for our vinyl are still good. They were written in such a way that I ticked out some of them myself, and they're perpetual. You know, I didn't know how they were at the time, but as we moved on and some of our contracts started to get to be 6, 8, 10 pages, and I talked to one of our really good music lawyers, and I said, you know, I've got this Earth Angel contract that is only one paragraph long. And he looked at it, and he says, and I said, I've got other ones since then that we're using with same guy that owns Earth Angel, and I said, maybe we should redo that contract so it'd be a little tighter. He says, your one paragraph's pretty tight. He says, I give you the right to use this song for 1 cent per album, and you will pay me the royalties every 6 months, period. That's all it says. He says, I would have a hard time attacking that. It says what you'll do, what he'll do, and doesn't say how long it'll run, so he doesn't say he has the right to stop it. So the fact is that we continued using that all the way to the end there.
Wow.
On that particular contract.
All right. I have a 45 at home. The song is called Mexican Midnight. And it's billed to a band called Art LeBeau and his group.
Yeah. What happened was I came up with this. I did not write the song. A guy just sent it to me. Sent me a tape from back east, a white guy, by the way. And I mean, not a Latino. He was pure white from the Midwest. And he banged it out on the piano. And I thought, you know, I needed a B-side. And we're in the studio with Ernie Freeman, I think, and some people. And we found these guys, the Candoli brothers, that can play triple tongue trumpets together,
Pete
a duet.
Kimberly?
Yeah, Pete and another one, and his brother. I can't remember his brother's name.
Poor guy. Everyone remembers Pete.
Yeah, and they were great. Yeah. And so we did this Mexican Midnight with studio musicians. They were there to record somebody else. So what name should we put on? I said, well, I think I'll just stick my name on it. That way we won't have any trouble with anybody. So they were all paid their union. It was a union session. And it was never a hit. It came out, I believe, in the right in the middle of the Beatles era, and I wasn't not real active in radio then.
It's not a hit yet. We're going to play it on Dublab, and you watch what happens.
It just might be, because it's really good, I think. Have you heard it?
Of course I've heard it. Yeah.
It's not bad, huh?
No, I think maybe some of the DJs will want to sample it.
I think the other side of it is called Pickwick Twist.
Yeah.
And the twist was big then in 1965. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to it, I mean, it's what an arrangement, you know, the way those horns overlap and especially on Pickwick Twist.
Now, you in talking about that song, you went out of your way to specify that the guy who wrote it was white and not Latino, not Mexican. And that, of course, brings up one of the really interesting and important things about your career, especially in the contemporary moment. Is just how popular you are with Mexican-American audiences throughout Southwest, but especially in Los Angeles and Southern California. For you, I mean, how did that come about? Is there a moment when you started noticing that your demographics were changing? And for you now, how important is it for you? I mean, you really are kind of honorary voice of Mexican America. And this has got to be a really rewarding and also kind of powerful thing for you.
I don't know about the powerful, but...
powerful
and
emotionally.
It's rewarding, certainly. Yeah. And they come to my concerts in droves, and sometimes there'll be as many as three generations that come to that. And that all started, you know, in the 50s when we couldn't have dances in Los Angeles. If you were under the age of 18, you could go to a concert, but you couldn't have a public dance unless it was sanctioned by the Board of Education. That was a city ordinance. So we had to go other places to do dances, because in those days, kids wanted to dance. They wanted a dance and a show. So we'd do three or four artists, and then we'd say... we'd play dance music, and then we'd say, okay, it's showtime, just like in the old nightclubs. Right. And then sometimes people would gather around, and if they were listening to Big Joe Turner, for instance, the first right in the bandstand, then El Monte, they weren't sitting down, they were standing. It was like a big dance ballroom, and just the floor. And so the first few rows would be listening. Standing up there. But beyond that, the bulk of the audience was dancing to the music. It was all very danceable, almost all that 50s music. And if it wasn't a regular danceable 4-4 rock and roll beat, we'd play a ballad, and then they'd do the standstill dancing, you know, standing in one spot and just moving their feet for the ballads. Mm-hmm. And they liked that too, you know.
And so from that moment, Mexican-American listenership has been a central part.
That started there where they were, you know, 15 and 16. Right. But an interesting phenomenon has taken place in the last year, let's say, that the really, really young kids, I'm not talking about teenagers now, 17 and 18 and 19, but a little bit younger than that, seem to be searching for their own music, just like the teenagers of the 50s wanted rock and roll and wanted to throw out the old bands. These really young kids are like the music of the 50s for some reason, especially the novelties. Mm-hmm. The kids that are, say, from 6 to 7 to about 11, or maybe even a little older, up to 12, down to maybe first graders, they seem to like 50s music. Like, when Christmas comes, I started with the Chipmunks or other things that we have that were Land of a Thousand Dances. They'll like that. Or they'll like some novelties, anything that's novel, and especially if it's true, straight-up rock and roll. Hmm. Like, I don't play a lot of Little Richard, but that's what they like. And it looks like it might be a force coming, because I have heard through other kids that they're liking to wear the 50s jackets and hairstyles and things. They're kind of reverting back. Like, I remember in the 70s, a lot of people, the girls, were liking the dresses and stuff of the 40s. They liked stuff from old movies, especially around here. It's interesting that I'm not sure that it's a growing phenomenon, but I'm getting enough of it since I let the little ones on the air that they seem to like the 50s music more so than they like the contemporary.
But
I think because it's easy to understand, they don't have to think about it. You know,
sure.
It's just right there. It says it says what it is.
Right.
You know, and some of it's nonsensical. Like once in a while, I play a song like Sea Cruise. You know, then I got to get to rocking, get my hat off the rack. I got to get to rocking like a knife in the back. I mean, it doesn't say anything. And because it's so nonsensical, the kids say, "Yeah, that's pretty good."
But I also think that, you know, when you look at the history of American popular music, you know, at least from the start of the 20th century, you know, people always talk about that early period of standards, of Tin Pan Alley standards, of a kind of the, you know, the repertoire of the American songbook. And what's really fascinating in hearing you talk and in thinking about the way that the so-called oldies never go away and are being requested by younger and younger people, is in a way you've created your own set of standards. You've created, at least for Mexican-Americans, for African-Americans in Los Angeles, in California, in the Southwest of the United States, you've created a whole new repertoire of a tradition where, yes, it's about dressing 50s, but it's also about keying into a tradition that connects you to your parents or even to your grandparents or to your community in your block, in your city, right? I mean, I think there's something there.
You know, it's so early in the game on it. I can't tell whether it's you know, guys any real traction or not. But it's definitely there. But I don't know how much traction it has yet, because I'm the only one doing it. So
right.
You know, I don't think anybody on traditional radio, terrestrial radio, is playing music out of the 50s at all.
Right. Which is good, extra
not,
good.
Does not get them a lot of
that
ratings.
You're on the
you
air
know.
So much. So there's multiple Art LeBeaus.
Well, you know, it still works. I mean, I'm with a very large radio organization, yeah. Clear Channel, and I'm on one of their, if not the major market, this in New York. And yet, you know, I have full autonomy on my show. And, you know, that's very, that's really something.
Yeah.
I think it says, hey, the radio station like Hot 92, its present monetary value is probably $500 million.
Right.
And for them to hand it to me for 31 hours a week and say, go ahead, be Art LeBeau. Well, you can bet that every month they're looking at the people meter too. But they're very... you know, they're very good people with me anyway, and I think, you know, basically they realize what the people meter is, and I'm not going to be number one all the time. But, you know, last month's ratings just came out, and they were excellent. It was way up in the top five, and in the English dominant 25-54, which is the money demo, I'm either number one or number two. Mm-hmm. In there, Power and Power 106 and me and Kiss,
it's
right
amazing.
There.
Amazing.
So, you know, they're there. There's a broad audience that just to expand a little on the young kids, the really young ones. I think when I first started this about a year ago, I think the ratings came out and I had a 76 share. On the people meter with kids 6 to 11. Now, a good share and a good rating in Los Angeles is a 4 share, 5 share. You can be number one with a 6 or a 7 share. But, I mean, it turned upside down. I don't know how many people meters, but there's nobody playing to the kids. So I suppose, you know, whoever they were sampling, I must have had most of them. And it was amazing to me that they printed it. And it happened for about 3 or 4 months in a row. It was either a 60 share or a 76.
That was amazing.
Topped out at meant 76% of kids that age were listening to this. And even the Disney Channel, which, you know, has miserable ratings, has no kids that I can see. I mean, they don't get them. They don't know.
So who knew the trick to getting kids to listen to the radio is play them their great-grandparents' music?
Yeah, and then you get the great grandparents listening too.
That's right. So Art, I want
to promote it that way. I don't know how they promote it. To be honest with you, I don't listen to it. But
you're not a secret Disney.
They've got a lot of stations around the country, all AMs mostly.
I want to end our chat, Art, by because you know you were talking. We started with you talking about how your listeners feel such a personal connection with you, and they share their lives with you every night on the air. And yet, it seems to me, Art, that you're actually, we don't know much about your personal life. So I want to ask you two personal questions that we can always edit out, but I want to ask you these questions. So the first one is, when you're done on the radio, what are you listening to at home?
Sometimes I record the latter part of my show and I listen to that. Just to get an idea.
Can't get enough of yourself?
Well, what I've done when I listen to the last part, when I say I record it, if I record the last hour of my show, I record it like my show's on till midnight. That show gets recorded at 10 o'clock while I'm on the air so that the phone calls that I take and all are immediate. They have to wait about the same length of time to get on as when I'm here live. So if I run out of gas sometimes, I do that. I don't do it every night, but I can do it. And it's interesting that the ratings don't show any difference. In one case, it showed them higher when I wasn't here. The shares are up a little, a share. And I thought, well, that's good. Maybe I don't have to deliver the body every night after all.
But so you are a fan, like a true fan of the music you play every night? Or do you go home and can't wait to go, oh, I really need to go listen to some experimental electronic music from 1981?
I'm like a lot of other people that have been doing it a long time that wear earphones and it's in their ears every night. Yeah. I don't listen to any music, you know, except my own show. And once in a while, I'll listen to competitors in my car when I'm driving home or something like that. But to me, while I'm doing it, I get a lot of it. I listen to it, and I do hear the music. Alan Freed once told me, if you don't listen to the music on the show and you're not in the show, they'll know.
Yeah.
He said they'll know if you don't comment or you're not part of it. So sometimes when I'm talking to listeners, they'll say, I want to do this song for my cousin Gilbert and so and so, and I'll write those names down and repeat them back. So okay, we're going to send this out then to your so and so. They like that. They like hearing their names on the air, and they particularly like hearing me say them. Right. I will do that. I may go out of my way to do that a lot.
So the last question I want to ask you, you know, much of Dublab's audience is very health conscious. It's a very health conscious audience. And you seem to have discovered the Fountain of Youth, Art LeBeau.
Well, I don't know about that.
We won't mention your age.
Why not?
All right.
It was in the LA Times on the front page.
But was it? All right, so how old are you?
I had a big article in the Times about 2 years ago, and I said, you have to put my age up there? And she says, well, I'll see. And boom, it came
so
out.
So you're
84-year-old
you're
DJ.
70. You're 70.
Huh?
You're 70.
No, I'm 86.
86. You look 65.
Oh, that's good.
What's the trick? Are there magic shakes, protein powders? What are you eating?
Well, I did
yoga?
Bump into a nutritionist when I was 48, and he put me on the right track on a lot of things like that. I was checking cholesterol and things like that back then.
It's incredible. And
so you could figure out how many years ago. It was 30 years, I guess, something like that. And he was very good. Matter of fact, I've outlived him. He was I've outlived about six of my doctors.
There's nothing better than outliving your nutritionist.
I got to tell you a story since we're on the subject of health. You might like this one. I don't know. But my friend Bill Gazzari, who used to own Gazzari's on the Strip, and he and I used to pal around together. And so when I started, you know.
Okay, we have to do part two of this interview, and I only want to hear you and Gazzari at night stories. But go ahead.
Well, that might be X-rated somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, this isn't. So I got him kind of, you know, watching his health. And you got to go in and have the doctor check your heart and, you know, cholesterol, try to explain things to him. And he said, oh, okay. So he used to go in. So he goes in to get his heart checked. And the guy's doing an EKG. Bill's on the table. And the doctor's standing over there. And the machine is running. And the doctor collapses and dies of a heart attack. It's a true story. And I said, it could only happen to Bill Ghazari. I mean, he's, and I said, what did you do? He said, I called for the nurse.
Incredible.
I said, did he really die or just have a heart attack? He said, no, he didn't die. He did not recover. But he felt, empowered there.
Right.
He outlived his doctor.
Well, I guess the
no such thing has happened to me. Most of them are, I usually like old school doctors, so they're usually were older than me. And they all live.
Do you exercise? Do you golf? What's the secret?
I exercise. I swim and I walk.
And you never stop. You always.
Well, I try to keep moving. That's important.
Yeah.
And I'll give you the three things I think you need to do. S-E-E. C. Remember that. Sleep, eat, exercise every day. Have a good sleep. And you can't always do that. But that if you're perfectly, if you sleep 8 hours a night, you eat nutritious three meals, which I don't. I try to, but I don't get it done either, with lots of vegetables and the Mideast diet and all that. And exercise. And that one's a hard one to squeeze in all the time, too. Because try to do it at the end of the day. I tried that. It just I'm usually tired by then. So I try to do it during the day or in the morning.
And the last one we can add is that oldies keep you young.
The music, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, if you dance to it, you know, it can keep you young. And talking to young people all the time helps a lot, you know, because I can still identify with it and tell jokes with the kids and everything.
Well, Art, I got to say, thank you for talking with us. It's been a great honor to speak with you. And not only, I should point out, local hero, regional hero of radio and music, but now soon to be inducted into the National Radio Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's exciting for me because, I started listening to the radio and being completely enmeshed in it when I was 8 years old. And when my sister sent us a radio, I lived in Utah there. I was born in Salt Lake. I was 8 years old. Radio itself was only, that would be in about nine. Radio itself was only about 10 years old. The whole first radio station came out in 1922. And I was born in 1925. But when I started listening, the radio was about eight. And when this radio came to our house in Utah, and we were living in a small little house, my sister had sent it to us. It's a little black box. And I said, Mom, the box talks. And I said, Mom, that's something. And I used to just sit and stare into the speaker. And my mother couldn't tear me away. Every day. And I used to hear all the announcers and how they would talk and how they were different. And dream someday I'd be in the box talking too, and being in the Radio Hall of Fame, being inducted there this November is a big thrill for me. I have a star in the Walk of Fame, as you probably know, but the Radio Hall of Fame is something real special for me. And I was up for it, nominated 2 years ago, didn't make it, but this year they sent me a letter and said you're going to be inducted, along with Howard Stern, by the way, and a couple of others.
All that matters to us is you. So we thank you for taking the time. It's been incredible to hear your stories, and I can speak on behalf of the entire DubLab team and all of the listeners and fans who you're a complete hero to. So we really thank you for sharing your life and your thoughts and your music with us.
And I'm going to check out DubLab some more, dublab.com.
You better. Thanks, Art.
Okay, bye-bye now. Bye.